You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In 1785, Thomas Jefferson wrote to James Madison about France. The property of this country is absolutely concentrated in a very few hands. I am conscious that an equal division of property is impracticable. But the consequences of this enormous inequality producing so much misery to the bulk of mankind, legislators cannot invent too many devices for subdividing property. What would Jefferson, Madison, or the contemporaries 230 years ago make of inequality today? Could some of the solutions they imagined then work now? Rutgers professors Joseph Blasi and Douglas Cruz and Harvard professor Richard Freeman consider issues of distribution, ownership, and democracy in their book, The Citizen's Share, Putting Ownership Back into Democracy. It's published by Yale University Press. I'm very pleased that it brings Joseph Blasi to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Nice to be here.
The three of you also co-edited a book called Shared Capitalism at Work. What's shared capitalism?
Shared capitalism is where through cash profit sharing or employee stock ownership that's broadly shared with workers or broad-based stock options as in Google and other tech companies where capital ownership is actually shared with workers, not just fixed wages.
Does this new book expand on that work or are you doing something different here?
Oh, it expands significantly. This is a book mainly of American history, telling stories from the founders to the present about how citizens, legislators, political thinkers, and especially people who actually ran companies shared profits and stock with workers.
The subtitle of this new book is Putting Ownership Back into Democracy. Was there a time when ownership was more widespread in democracies or in American democracy?
Oh, absolutely. Despite the fact that they disagreed on many things and despite a lot of hypocrisies. Many of the founders, most of the founders, agreed that broad-based property ownership was absolutely essential for a republic to exist.
But when they were talking about property, they were talking about something else. We were very much a country of farms. Some of these people had very large properties themselves. Thomas Jefferson, George Washington.
Absolutely. They were reading a variety of political thinkers in Europe who talked about the fact that the main form of capital, land, had to be broadly, not strictly equally distributed, but broadly distributed for a democratic state to exist. And they all agreed very firmly on this. And what we do in the book is we look through their writings and find this broad agreement.
What would you identify as the leading economic problem Americans face today? Is it poverty, inequality, unemployment, underemployment, indebtedness?
I think the leading domestic problem is inequality because I think inequality is the engine that pushes poverty and pushes many of the other problems that we have.
And inequality has gotten a lot of press this year. President Obama pointed to minimum wages in his Labor Day speech yesterday. But do Americans agree on what the leading economic problem is today?
I think that there is broad agreement that inequality is one of the top problems. It certainly has not gone out of the press, even though we've had so many terrible foreign policy conflicts.
But it doesn't seem to be having much of an impact on the lead-up to the midterm elections.
Well, the reason why it doesn't have a lead-up is because both political parties are really hypocrites in this matter. The Republicans think that reducing our taxes $1,000 to $3,000 every time we have a big tax piece of legislation will somehow magically cure our inequality. And Democrats think that implementing the minimum wage for a few million workers talking about the middle class and its decline will also do the same. Neither of those really can address the problem of inequality because inequality is a problem of inequality in capital.
In an essay in the Financial Times a few weeks ago, the economist Deirdre McCloskey argued that inequality is irrelevant if the conditions of the poor are improving.
Well, first of all, let's be clear. I would love the conditions of the poor to improve, and we need to do many, many things, such as equal wages for men and women, the minimum wage, and many things to improve the conditions of the poor. But the core cause of inequality is that wages adjusted for inflation are flat, largely because of globalization and the decline of unions. And most of the households with wealth have that wealth because they have capital. They own stock. They own parts of companies. They get shares and profits. That's what you have to go at to address inequality. You can't address inequality by increasing people's wages. It's not going to close the gap.
What did Jefferson or the other founders think would be the consequences of inequality in their time?
They were very clear. They thought that the consequences of inequality would be one of two things. One, that the unpropertied masses, because we had one person, one vote, would simply legislate a form of redistribution. Higher taxes, take the wealth from the rich and give it to the poor.
But we didn't have one person, one vote at the beginning.
Absolutely. Many of them were hypocrites on this issue. We didn't have one person, one vote. But they even feared this with the white men who had votes. And they were terribly fearful of the rebellions that occurred, the economic rebellions in Massachusetts and in Pennsylvania.
Shays Rebellion.
Was that
exactly based on inequality?
Well, it was based on a lot of fears that there would be more concentrated property ownership and that taxes would create takings on what was essentially the middle class at the time.
In that letter to Madison, Jefferson said an equal division of property would be impracticable, but he also wrote the Declaration of Independence with the line that all men are created equal. What did he mean by equality there?
Well, I can't get into his mind. He had a vision of equality, both political and economic equality, that was focused on males who were active at the time.
White males.
Thankfully, John Adams, later president of the United States, had strong views on this issue. He also was strongly anti-slavery. And he articulated a notion that if you had concentrated property ownership, the second problem that they feared, that the rich would take control of the legislative system, which is largely what has happened today.
When Jefferson wrote of subdividing property, was he calling for redistribution from the haves to the have-nots?
No, he wasn't. For example, when he drafted the first draft of the Virginia Constitution, he wanted public land distributed to every white male.
It was public land, not his own.
Right. It was public land, and it was not his own. I think it's really important to look at this tradition and focus on something like the Northwest Ordinance. The Northwest Ordinance, before the U.S. Constitution, took many of the territories in the Northwest, by the way, abolished slavery and servitude in those territories and made it possible for households to have large amounts of land. They did do something. The Homestead Act under President Lincoln was the last big time that public land was broadly distributed.
And that allowed poor people to suddenly have, people who would not have had any other opportunity.
Absolutely. And the important thing about the Homestead Act is it included women for the first time. So there were many women homesteaders. About 20% of homesteaders were women. And later, African Americans became homesteaders after some fits and starts. But the Speaker of the House of Representatives for Abraham Lincoln at the end of the Homestead Act said, you know what? We've essentially run out of land. The future of this is shares of profits and ownership in corporations. And that updates to our book.
Because I was wondering, through the 1800s, was land still the principal factor in production in addition to labor?
Oh, land was certainly the principal factor. But starting about 1880, a number of business people, William Cooper Proctor from the Procter & Gamble family in Ohio, Charles Pillsbury in Minnesota, they were aware of this agrarian tradition of broad-based property ownership, and they tried to implement shares of property in their corporations.
In a sense, the Civil War was about property. It was about slavery. Did it bring changes in American capitalism? And is there a link? Can we see a link between the Civil War and the thinking about the first Homestead Act?
Well, I think it brought three changes, and some of them contradict each other. First of all, when the Southern representatives withdrew from Congress, the Civil War allowed President Lincoln to pass the Homestead Act and really take a big step forward in that broad-based property ownership tradition. Secondly, however, the Civil War, with all of the munitions and supplies going to the Army from corporations, strengthened corporations that were representatives of concentrated ownership. On the other hand, the third thing, the Civil War raised in the consciousness of people like Charles Pillsbury, William Cooper Proctor, and others, George Eastman, who founded Kodak, that you had to figure some way within corporations to have shares of property ownership. And that was a good thing.
Joseph R. Blasi is my guest. He is co-author. Did we say co-author when there were three authors?
Absolutely.
With Richard B. Freeman and Douglas L. Cruz of The Citizen's Share, Reducing Inequality in the 21st Century. Modern economies were only just beginning to emerge in the late 18th century. Could the founders have meant the same thing that we do today when they talked about worker ownership?
Well, what they talked about is that citizens should have enough property ownership to be economically independent, and they wanted the main form of capital, land, to be owned by them. Madison, interestingly enough, in 1829, he predicted what the amount of land would be in the United States 100 years in the future and how many people there would be. He divided one and the other, and he said, you know what, this idea of broad-based land ownership won't work. We have to find another way for people to have broad-based ownership. And interestingly enough, his daughter was dating and subsequently married a fellow who was looking at worker cooperatives, studying worker ownership. And a Madison household actually received Robert Owen's circular and newsletter on worker ownership. And Owen went to meet with Madison, and they had a discussion about worker ownership.
And where did the idea of worker cooperatives, worker ownership, arise from? From the United States?
No. Profit sharing really, as far as we can tell, started in terms of modern businesses in France. But worker cooperatives were very common in England. And they came to the United States in the writings of various social scientists around 1840, 1850.
Adam Smith published Wealth of Nations of the same year that America declared its independence.
Absolutely. But many people don't realize that in Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, he talked about sharecroppers who were more productive because they own a share of land, not the American sharecropping, which was mixed with the evil of racism.
Most of the names we associate with the founding fathers were fairly wealthy, but by contrast, some of the most radical colonists like Thomas Paine, Ethan Allen, and Thomas Young were poor and remain so. Do we know what they thought about redistributing wealth or worker ownership?
Well, sure. Thomas Paine was very much in favor of there being broad-based property ownership. In fact, he favored something similar to the Alaska Permanent Fund. I'm not sure if many of your listeners know what that is. It's really interesting, where many of the oil revenues from Alaska are invested and distributed as a dividend check to every citizen of Alaska. That was essentially Thomas Paine's idea.
But people in Alaska are against any kind of large government. Did they not see the connection between the two?
You know, it's interesting. Even Sarah Palin was in favor of the Alaska Permanent Fund, and it was started by a conservative Republican governor. And this is where the bipartisan or nonpartisan nature of the book comes up. Broad-based property ownership within a market economy has been a bipartisan issue in the 250 years of American history we look at.
But companies were very different entities 230 years ago. Adam Smith described how a division of labor allowed 10 workers to turn out 48,000 pins a day. Today, a machine in China can turn out perhaps 48 million pins.
Sure. And this gets to the big issue, because it really isn't enough just to have workers own their firms, because what is really happening is that capital is producing most of the wealth in the country. So we need to figure out a way for workers to own the robots of the future, to own the technology of the future. And I think we need ideas like the dividend-paying Alaska Permanent Fund owning solar energy farms and wind energy farms and robots and technologies of the future where citizens receive income. That's another idea in the book.
My guest is Joseph R. Blasi. He and fellow Rutgers professor Douglas Cruz, along with Harvard professor Richard Freeman, have written a book called The Citizen's Share, Reducing Inequality in the 21st Century. It's published by Yale University Press. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Joseph R. Blasi, who is co-author with Richard B. Freeman and Douglas L. Cruz of The Citizen's Share, Reducing Inequality in the 21st Century, published by Yale University Press. Thomas Piketty's proposal for inequality is a global wealth tax. Is that different than your proposal?
Sure.
Because he gives you a nice blurb.
No, I know. We really very much appreciate Thomas's blurb about this broad American property tradition. Thomas's proposal has two parts. One is a global wealth tax of 1 to 2% of total assets, and secondly is a high income tax, 70 to 80% of income every year. That's really redistribution of wealth. Piketty's view is that really it's not going to be likely without that to really equalize property ownership. Ours is different. What we're saying is if the inequality in capital ownership and capital income, such as capital gains, explains most of economic inequality, why not address it directly by broadening shares of ownership in the place where people work and by allowing citizens to receive dividend checks like the Alaska Permanent Fund?
What we're seeing right now is the accumulation of great wealth in very small sectors. How do you go about changing that? Would it take major legislation?
I don't think it would take major legislation.
Because you're not going to get it from any Congress in the near future.
Well, here's the choice. There really is a stark choice. If you accept the notion, and we have research beyond Piketty from many sources, top 10% owns about 3/4 of all wealth, 80% of financial assets in the top 10%, keeps getting worse. If you accept that notion, then we really have three choices. We could go to what I call feudalism with a constitution, right? Where the English aristocracy owned 80% of land at the time of the American Revolution. We're getting to those numbers. Or we could go to Thomas Piketty's redistribution ideas. By the way, James Madison said if you didn't have broad-based property ownership, you would get to redistribution discussions. It wasn't just Piketty's idea. And thirdly, it's the idea that we talk about. Tax incentives so that every business will consider having a cash profit sharing plan, an ESOP or employee stock ownership plan.
But sometimes when companies try to do that, it still doesn't work, as we just saw recently with Volkswagen trying to unionize a plant in the South and the workers voting against it. Volkswagen wanted to do it because then they'd be able to implement the work structures that they have in Germany, and workers voted down the union.
Well, I think there's a difference between shares of ownership and profits and unions. They can certainly go together with the idea of unions.
But often unions wound up getting involved in boards of directors and such and making major decisions on how corporations were run. So wouldn't that be part of what you're talking about?
Certainly. If you have a situation where workers own a large part of a corporation, they would deserve to have a seat at the table on the board of directors. You know, early in the 1900s, William Cooper Proctor, the grandson of the founder of Procter & Gamble, the workers there owned about 10% or so of the company, and he did offer the workers to have board seats, and they would have an election, and they actually had seats on the board of directors. That's certainly an issue. In the Volkswagen case, however, profit sharing, employee stock ownership wasn't really an issue. It was really a union vote.
If there are great inequalities in income across different industries, wouldn't there still be inequality even with worker ownership of their firms?
Well, I think so. So, for example, one can imagine a janitorial company that hires out janitorial services. If they had profit sharing or worker ownership, certainly one could not imagine that the workers would make as much money as Google engineers with their broad-based stock options and profit sharing.
One advantage of Piketty's global wealth tax is that the wealthy wouldn't be able to relocate to dodge taxes. Couldn't American businesses relocate to avoid reforms to ownership?
I think that's absolutely the case. Business can relocate. One of the things we do in our book, and Doug and Richard and I spend a lot of time working on this, is we review about 100 years of research on shares of ownership and shares of profits by workers and companies, and we found that generally companies do as well, if not better. And that's a real reason for companies to do this.
If workers take a significant ownership stake, do they also have to take a part in decision making? Do they have to run the company?
Well, they don't have to run the company. Most workers don't want to be running the company and sitting on the boards. What they want is they want to have a role at their division, at their workplace, in their department. Certainly, if workers own 20%, 50% of a company, they would want to have some role in the board of directors. But we're talking mostly about profit sharing in small family businesses and broad-based employee ownership and stock options, maybe 20% of a Fortune 500 company.
I would think that there are more people owning businesses today than ever before, many of them owning franchises, et cetera, but that the concentration of wealth still winds up being at the top of McDonald's, not at the local franchise restaurant.
Well, sure, there is a broad family business and entrepreneurial sector in the United States, and that's good. That's part of this broad-based property ownership tradition. It's not just, you know, employee ownership and profit sharing. That needs to be counted. But it is also true that most of the big new capital inventions are owned by a very small group of people.
Hasn't the trend over the past 30 years been for greater division between ownership and control?
Oh, well, sure. Well, that's another issue of corporate governance. We have this odd situation in the United States where institutional investors own more than 80% of the stock market, and that you can hardly find an institutional investor who has a seat on a board of directors. This has to be addressed. It was one of the reasons why we had the last financial collapse. Investors didn't have a seat at the table. Management-dominated boards.
Could current patterns of ownership and control be a division of labor along the lines of what Adam Smith observed? Top decision makers are specialists in management, shareholders own capital and take risks, workers are specialists in their areas.
Well, I disagree with that because we are in a different era right now where many workers are knowledge workers. You know, the old cookie factory where workers carried sacks of flowers and the managers were designing the cookies, that's a different world. If you walk into a modern cookie factory, you have three shifts running 24 hours, teams of workers doing changeovers between chocolate chip cookies and vanilla cookies. And you know what those workers have? Many of them have high skill training. They understand how to work those computers. They have profit sharing. They're also knowledge workers.
My guest is Joseph R. Blasi of Rutgers. He, along with Richard B. Freeman and Douglas L. Cruz, have written The Citizen Share, Reducing Inequality in the 21st Century. It's published by Yale University Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Are there any firms that you think really stand out as examples of successful employee ownership?
Oh, absolutely. In Chapter 3 of the book, we talk about many, many examples. So among publicly traded companies, I think Procter & Gamble stands out. Microsoft stands out. Google stands out. They all use combinations of profit sharing and broad-based employee ownership. Among closely held companies, there are about 10,000 ESOPs, small, privately held companies where workers own 30 to 100% of the firm across the United States. King Arthur Flour, Eileen Fisher Fashion here in New York State. And then among tech companies, broad-based employee ownership is common.
It's called Employee Stock Ownership Plan, or ESOP.
Right. In closely held companies, mostly ESOPs, Employee Stock Ownership Plan.
What percentage of a company has to be owned by employees for the company to count as worker-owned?
Well, if you want to call it worker-owned, it should be 51%. But a company with employee ownership could have as much as 10 or 20%, and that can have an important impact on the performance of the workers and on their personal wealth.
You list several Citizens shares among the Fortune 100. What are some of the firms that are particularly notable?
Well, I think that, for example, I mentioned Microsoft before. Microsoft has had broad-based employee ownership since its founding. Gates wrote about it a lot. They've also had forms of gain sharing and profit sharing.
He's still one of the richest people in the world, so not all the money is flowing downward.
No, I know. But there's a difference between him and Larry Ellison, for example, whose company Oracle doesn't have a broad-based employee ownership. Procter & Gamble is about, I estimate, 20% employee-owned.
Now, Amazon is one of the companies listed, but hasn't it been criticized for having very poor conditions for many of its workers?
Absolutely. And my research indicates to me that Amazon is probably retrenched to more for retrenched to employee ownership more for its headquarters employees and less for its rank and file workers.
And GM is also on the list, but it's been plagued by recalls over the past year based on poor management decisions.
Absolutely. GM, after they got reorganized, had broad-based stock options, and they have profit sharing. But I think it's really important to point out that GM probably hasn't been sufficiently organized to have broad-based employee involvement in decision-making and quality. Ford always had a focus on teams and self-directed work teams. GM always resisted this, and I would have to think that some of that old culture is still with the so-called new GM.
But in Japan and in Germany, they have, and in Scandinavia, they have the other approaches. Has that led to the production of better cars?
Well, it's hard to talk about cars because virtually every automaker has been plagued with huge recalls. One can make really bad decisions at the top. So, for example, Kodak had probably invented broad-based stock options, broad-based profit sharing for all of its workers, employee ownership, and they missed the digital revolution.
And they
hardly exist anymore. If you make a bad strategic mistake, no amount of shares is going to help you out.
Haven't business managers implemented many of the programs you describe as an incentive for greater effort among workers, which would suggest that current managers are more interested in effort and productivity than in democracy and equality?
Well, it's true that many managers do that. But, for example, if you look at the Google founder statement at the time they founded their firm, they said they wanted workers who created these new innovations to share in the fruits. And one of the things we see in our book, we tell many of the stories from Procter & Gamble, George Eastman, and many other firms. They really believed in the broad property ownership part of this idea, not just in the effort push idea.
Last year, Time magazine reported that a New York City realty firm, Rapid Realty, was offering a 15% raise to workers who got tattooed with the company's logo.
Well, I don't like that. That violates my sense of public versus private space.
On the other hand, Avis Rent-A-Car was employee-owned from 1987 to 1996, and then it was sold to HFS. Why did the employees choose to sell their own company?
Well, I don't know why they chose to sell their own company. I think most of the decision was probably made by the majority owner. Avis was not 100% employee-owned. When you have a good profit sharing or company with employee ownership, having management that believes in that idea is important to the future.
There also isn't there an airline that is partly employee owned with the idea that that was going to improve the way they dealt with the consumer, and it hasn't worked out that way?
Well, no, that's not really true. Southwest, which is one of the most profitable airlines, has profit sharing for all of its employees. Last quarter, they gave 30% of all their profits to their employees. But I do think it's very important to state, employee ownership isn't 100% good idea. I don't think that the form of employee ownership where workers buy stock with their savings in 401k plans is a good idea, like Enron. More interested in forms of employee ownership where workers receive grants of stock, as in ESOPs.
Are some companies better suited to employee ownership or to other employee sharing programs of the kind that you discuss than others?
There has been this notion out there that maybe the software firm with the knowledge workers and such, but actually we find, for example, in public supermarkets, if you're in Georgia or Florida, 100% employee-owned, very noted for their customer service. So there are a lot of firms which are more low-tech kind of firms, small margin profit kind of firms. Worker ownership works up fairly well there.
Today, capital and finance seem to dominate the economic landscape. How can citizens share in an area that's so poorly understood by most of us?
Well, I think that finance should be leading the revolution in broadening property ownership. I'd like to see a national commission set up with many members of Wall Street firms to figure out how to expand tax incentives so that every company will consider a broad-based profit-sharing plan or an employee stock ownership plan.
Don't many people link the decline in union membership with the increase in inequality?
Oh, absolutely, because unions fought for workers to receive a share of the fruits of their labor.
And now there seems to be actually a hostility, as I mentioned earlier, in the Volkswagen plant.
Oh.
People don't want to join unions, especially white males, according to the latest statistics.
It's true, but it is also the case that at least half of Americans are still very positive about unions. I think that unions have had a hard time with globalization getting a share of the fruits for workers, and profit sharing and employee ownership and stock options also can help unions supplement their fixed wages.
Since the Reagan administration here in the Thatcher years in Britain, there's been a strong move towards privatization, and even Bill Clinton talked to privatizing Social Security. Is that a separate issue from what you're discussing?
I think it is. I think it is a very separate issue. Certainly, if one wanted to have citizen shares all over the country, you could ask the question, a fair question, what about our members in the military? What about teachers, people who work with children? That's why I think something like the Alaska Permanent Fund, which provides dividend checks to citizens, would be helpful to workers in industries, in sectors that can have shares.
I've always wondered why we didn't see more teams like the Green Bay Packers, which are owned and operated as a nonprofit by the people of the area.
Well, absolutely. But the Green Bay Packers form of team ownership is more of a symbolic form. For example, many people buy stock certificates in the Packers and never really cash them in. It's more of a symbolic issue. I do think, though, however, that in professional sports, broad-based profit sharing would be a good idea.
With Labor Day just over, there have been several labor-related news stories. Reports yesterday of casinos closing in Atlantic City. If employees own the casinos, isn't it likely that they would have stayed open long past their viability?
Well, I think it's important to note that employee ownership is not a solution to any problem. Atlantic City overbuilt casinos. If employee owned those casinos, I'm not sure they would have been built in the first place, seeing what's happening in Pennsylvania and in other states. As I indicated with Kodak, you can make really bad strategic errors. What really we're really talking about in the book is a 250-year share tradition in American history that can be applied today and help supplement the fixed wages of the middle class.
In contrast, the New York Times reported yesterday about workers claiming wage theft, cases where employers have failed to pay wages that the employees are owned.
There's no fix other than enforcing the law for an illegal employer.
My great thanks to Joseph Blasi, who is co-author along with Richard Freeman and Douglas Cruz of a book called The Citizen Share, Reducing Inequality in the 21st Century. The book is published by Yale University Press, and I thank you so much for being on our show. It's been a fascinating conversation.
Delighted to be here. Thank you.